The Supreme Court hears oral arguments in the bump stock ban case, plus an interview with former NRA board member and whistleblower Phil Journey. That and more on this episode of the Weekly Reload Podcast.
No, the devil's got no hold on me.
Ooh. All right. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Weekly Reload Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Gutowski. I'm also a CNN contributor and the founder of TheReload.com, where you can head over and sign up for our free newsletter right now if you want to get a once-a-week update on what's going on with guns in America, if you want to keep up with the latest without cluttering your mailbox. Just nice, simple, easy way to stay up to date. Of course, you can also buy a membership because we are a fully independent publication and we rely on our member dues to operate. And of course, it also gives you access to hundreds of pieces of writing, pieces of analysis, original stories that you will not find anywhere else in the world. So you get a great benefit for actually buying that membership in addition to supporting our work. This week, we are focused once more on the NRA's trial. The outcome of the case obviously came down. We talked about it in detail last week on the podcast. This week, we are going to be speaking with somebody who was directly affected by it, who was somebody who was a key witness in the case and potentially a player in the future of the NRA as well, Judge Phil Journey, who is a former board member, also running again for the board, and was found to be a whistleblower who did not receive proper protections by the jury in this civil case. So welcome to the show, Judge. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Stephen. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Absolutely. Can you just tell people a little bit more about yourself who might not have heard of you before?
Well, okay. You know, I'm a district court judge. I serve in a county, a jurisdiction of about 500,000 people, largest city in the state. I'm one of about 30 judges. Right now I'm focused on family law. That's my assignment. And so I do lots of divorces and paternity cases and lots of cases involving domestic violence. I've done criminal jury trial, ran the traffic department. Before I was a judge, I was a state senator in Kansas, wrote right to carry, preemption, range protection, and actually got Kansas to become a legalized class 3 and title 2 devices. So I've been busy, served on the board from, I was first nominated in 94 by petition, nominated by the nominating committee in 95, elected, went through the battle in Seattle in 97. Got ostracized and kicked off the board again. And then, you know, I got back after the fiasco in Indianapolis with Oliver North. Got back on the board and served 3 more years. And now I'm trying to get back on again, see if we can save what's left.
Yes. And you had basically the same experience the second time around, right?
You know, the second time around, yes, I was ostracized again. You know, speaking truth to power sometimes is a little difficult.
Hmm. And so, you know, like I mentioned at the intro there, the jury found in this civil case in New York that you were one of 8 people who they identified as whistleblowers that they found the NRA did not properly protect from retaliation. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I was satisfied with that. I thought it actually made the slings and arrows a little less hurtful to know that someone recognized the reality of the circumstances I had to serve under.
Hmm. And, you know, obviously the big ticket item that the jury came away with, or maybe a couple big ticket items, but the major one was that the NRA failed to safeguard its charitable assets as an institution. And then, of course, that Wayne LaPierre, who was the longtime executive vice president, head of the NRA, did $5.4 million worth of damage to the organization through, you know, diverting funds towards personal expenses. And then Woody Phillips, the former treasurer, did another $2 million worth of harm to the organization. What's your reaction to that part of the finding?
I think they got off cheap. If you look at the reality of the, and of course the trial looked at a very narrow window of time, approximately a decade, when in fact, my experience with these individuals and the association spans over three decades. And I can tell you that, it was much worse my second time on the board than it was on the first, and the way the association was run and the way the board operated. It's quite clear that when they filed that bankruptcy and squandered 400,000 members' dues on that harebrained scheme to get away from the New York Attorney General and get away from this trial that they just lost, it is tragic that it has gone so far. And the NRA has fallen so far too.
And what do you, the interesting thing here about this verdict, right, is that you've got kind of the jury and they're what they've found as the fact finders, but there isn't any sort of immediate effect from this verdict, because apparently we're not going to get the sentencing phase for this trial where the judge, you know, makes a determination on what the proper repercussions are until July, it sounds like. At least that's what he was saying.
That's the best guess they have right now is July. That was a real disappointment. I know if I had a trial like this, it's kind of like a Band-Aid. I just want to get it over with. Idle hands or the devil's workshop and this 4 or 5 months now that will be in, probably in between the first and second phase of the trial. Idle hands at the devil's workshop, and the lawyers will be able to do what they do for 5 months rather than just a few days, which would have been my option. If I could do it, I would have said, let's just get moved to phase two tomorrow and just see what you do with safe harbor.
Yeah. I guess the judge didn't have time on his schedule for another multi-week, I guess, series of hearings. So.
Being tied up in the trial for about 6 weeks, I can only imagine what that did to his calendar. You know, I'm sure there are hundreds of judges in that building and they're all very busy. And I'm sure he has lots of cases to take care of. And people have been waiting patiently. And sometimes it takes years to get to court in New York.
Yeah, well, it did in this case, right? I mean, this was the investigation started in 2019. The allegations first came to public view in 2018. So it's been quite a long time now that we're sitting here in 2024. But it does feel like these next couple of months are going to be fairly pivotal as well, even though this is sort of drug on for so long, because they're coming in 2024, an election year where the NRA does not appear poised to be able to play a very significant role, at least not as significant as it had, say, in 2016 or 2020. In the elections. And you have this period now where there's going to be several months before we even get to the conclusion, the sort of sentencing aspect of this case. And maybe there'll be appeals after that point, but we don't know.
I don't know that there'll be enough to save. That's what scares me. You know, when we got involved in the bankruptcy in 2021, NRA was in so much better financial shape than it is today. The reality is that over my 3 years on the term from the board from 2020 to 2023, NRA lost 1 million members, maybe a little bit more. And in the year following, the year that I have been off the board, it appears that they've lost up to another 1 million members. And they're quickly approaching the threshold of falling below 4 million members if the trends all hold from what we've seen in the last 5 years' performance. So is the income.
Well, right. Well, we don't really know how many members they have, because you've got board members, current board members. Buzz Mills said he thinks it's around 3 million. Willis Lee has said publicly he thinks it's at 3.8. The NRA disputed Buzz Mills' lower number, but they wouldn't give an estimate. For, you know, the spokesperson at the NRA wouldn't give an estimate. So we don't know exactly how many members are left at this point. But I do think it's clear that there's far less than there were even last year.
If you believe what the officers say, they don't know either. And that just blows me away. And my second from the last board meeting, I had become a little more frustrated than I am at this moment. And, you know, I'd gone to the finance committee meeting, saw the numbers, saw what was going on with the finances. We go to the board meeting. When they start the board meeting, you know, the officers give their reports, and Willis Lee got up and told everyone, the 5 million members of the NRA are so proud of the job this board is doing. And I knew that number was not accurate. And so when they made the presentation of the Finance Committee meeting, resolutions and things from their work, I got up and I, you know, Cotton kind of rolled his eyes, because we can ask questions as board members of the committee chairman or people delivering the report. And he goes, yes, Mr. Durney. And I said, I just want to know how many members we actually have today. Because I knew it was less than 5 million, and I knew they were hiding it from the board. And everybody looked at each other up there at the officer's table above the, in front of the board, and kind of like deer in the headlights. And they all said, including staff and Wayne LaPierre, that they did not know.
Yeah, and it seems like that might still be the case at this point.
That's what I'm now, thinking, you know, too.
NRA membership numbers are obviously going to be a bit skewed by the fact that they offer lifetime memberships, and it's probably fairly difficult to figure out when someone's lifetime membership ends because they pass away. You know, the NRA isn't necessarily trolling around the obituaries to figure that out. But
that's not where the losses are coming. The losses are coming with annual membership dues renewals, and those dues renewals are what keeps the association going. When I joined as a life member in the early 80s, you know, I sent my $25 a month in for, or a quarter in for 5 years to pay my first, my life membership. And I know that when they got that money, it went right out the door, and there's nothing in there to keep my magazine coming except the dues paid by annual members as they renew. Renewals are off. We're off 40%. The last year that I had the numbers on, the trend is an increasing rate of change over the last 5 years. And you can look at the trends and see that they're on the downward slope of the hockey stick, because they've crossed the threshold and it's on the way down. And if they don't get 2 or 3 million members renewals a year, they lose about $100 million. And right now the budget is less than half of what it was just 10 years ago.
Well, and just to that point, I think it's difficult for anyone, especially outside the organization, to put a fine number on it. But I will say on the membership, but I will say that there are some indicators, right? Like the circulation for the magazines is one. Another one is how many ballots get sent out to vote in the board member elections, because those go to lifetime members and people who've had membership for 5 consecutive years. And in 2023, that number was about 2.5 million. And so if they've gotten to a point where they're only, and you know, so those are going to be your members who are least likely to leave. One, because I don't even know if you can give up your lifetime membership.
Yes. It does happen.
Okay. But you know, if you've already paid for it, and a lot of people aren't going to just give up their lifetime member, you do still obviously get benefits for being an NRA member if you don't like the direction the group is headed in. But, you know, if the number really is down to 3.8 or 3 somewhere, that would be a pretty remarkable collapse in support among the people that you mentioned, the sort of annual member types or the 3-year member, the shorter term members. Which do drive a lot of revenue, because lifetime members don't have to pay in anymore if they don't want to.
Right. And so if you take the 2.5 million life and above members or voting members, which does have a small cluster of 5 years without a lapse, which is really hard for most people to do because they forget to send the check, it lapses and they start the 5-year period over. If it's 2.5 million voting members, then it's 1.3 million that are renewing, that are carrying the load and keeping the association open, when just 5 years ago, it was 3 million members carrying the load with their annual membership.
So, yeah. And so I think that gives people a lot of insight into where things potentially are right now, which is a very dim picture, the overall health of the NRA. But it also, I think, maybe transitions us a little bit into some of the critiques about how the NRA is run and how things got to this point where they lost a case like this civil case. And one of those is, you know, how these elections run. You can only vote in the election under these circumstances you just mentioned, which leaves out, I mean, at its peak, that left out like half the membership couldn't vote outside of the one board member, the 76 member, which you can only vote in that election if you show up to the annual meeting, which only gets, even at its peak, about 80,000 attendees. So you're leaving out massive swaths of NRA membership don't actually get any say in how the organization is run. And there's lots of critiques about the size of the board. There's just the 76 people on the board. What I'm interested in here, though, is your view as somebody who wants to reform the organization from inside and has now running to be back on the board again. What is your long-term vision for the NRA? How would you fix these issues?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is train everybody so they understand their lanes. The choice of the next executive vice president to replace Wayne LaPierre is absolutely critical. It could live or die on that choice. If the board and the staff and the officers could follow the rules, then I think we could resurrect the organization and, like a phoenix, rise from the ashes. So they have to change. These old dogs have to learn some new tricks. They have to learn what it really means to have your fiduciary duty and to fulfill it and to use business sense as required by the law to make these decisions. Don't forget, another trial is coming up, too, at the end of April with the Washington, D.C. Attorney General and the NRA Foundation. That's really their Achilles heel. If that goes bad for them, and they are required to pay $300 or $400 million back to the foundation because it was given to them outside of the parameters of how a C3 is supposed to operate, you know, that could just collapse the whole house of cards right now, which is pretty fragile as we speak.
Right, because the NRA, a lot of your average person really doesn't really understand. A lot of these big groups like the NRA are actually a number of legally distinct entities. The NRA obviously has the C4, which is what I think most people talk about, which is the membership part of the organization. Like if you buy an NRA membership, you are joining the 501c4 part of the group. But of course, they have PACs, political action committees, and a super PAC. And those are because the C4 is limited in how it can spend money in elections, whereas those have different rules attached to them. Like if you donate to the PAC, for instance, your name goes on a government form and it's shown that you donated to the NRA's political victory fund is what it's called. And then at the same time, they also have, like you just mentioned, foundations, 501c3s, where, you know, you get a tax write-off if you donate to that part of the NRA, and it's only focused on non-political issues like the training,
you know, education, safety
training, sure. Education. And but of course, there's lots of rules about how you can move money around between these organizations. And, you know, people are always trying to push the limits of those rules. And so that's part of what's at risk in this foundation case that you're getting at. And if the NRA had to pay back, the C4 had to pay a lot of money back to the C3, it could, you're saying that could really ruin the organization, I guess.
Well, right now, NRA is running on fumes. I don't know how well they did in Pennsylvania at the Sportsman Show there. And then, you know, we've got the
annual meeting. They did claim record turnout for that. So
yeah. So they probably did pretty good. They probably made 15, 20, 25 million bucks. And they could keep the door open for 10 months with that. But as we speak, they're burning $50,000 a day and losing 1,000 members a day at the last time we were able to do the math based on the numbers. And it's probably worse now than it was a year ago, because it was the previous year was better than that year. And it, you know, it started with like a 10% change and then a 15 and a 25 and then a 40. And, you know, we're on the downward slope now, going straight to the bottom. Mm-hmm.
But so for as far as your long-term vision for the NRA and how to reform it, you know, beyond making sure people follow their fiduciary responsibilities, I guess, as officers and board members. Would you change anything about the structure of the NRA, the
elections? Well, I think there's a lot of things. I hear often that a 76-member board is unwieldy, and I know that's true. It's about like running a legislative chamber. That's where I really learned about how committee work works and, you know, how to get things through the process. And then I used what I learned on the NRA board the first time when I went to the Kansas Senate. I think that my thought is that it needs to be a business political management board, maybe 15 at the most, smaller than that, as long as it's an odd number. And then the other work that the NRA does, the mountains of work we do, that's like 95% of the organization's mission, is things that we never see in television: kids programs, women's programs, law enforcement support, the competitions, and all that. And so we have a discipline board that would be the committees like high power and F class and small bore and things like that. And they would all get together, not as often as the business board, and work on the rule books, work on sanctioning the national and state matches, and then, you know, go on from there. And they provide a valuable service because the shooting sports needs to be regulated fairly and in a timely way so that the sport can progress.
Okay. So you would make significant structural changes to how the NRA's governance works.
I think it would be in the NRA's best interest, yes.
Okay. What about some of these officer positions? You know, some of these things get rolled up several positions into one person. That you've seen a lot of that at the NRA. Wayne LaPierre was not just the executive vice president. He was also the CEO. He served as well as a sort of spokesperson role too. John Fraser right now is the general counsel, but he's also the secretary of the board. Is that a concern as well, that some of these positions have been too consolidated?
Yes, absolutely. When you look at that, if they end up as an officer in two different positions with countervailing duties, you know, what do they do? Like, you know, he's general counsel, but he's also the secretary, for example, with Mr. Fraser. There were a number of times where those two could get in the way of the other. And I think it's important that at one person, one office, everybody knows their job, everybody knows their lane, and they keep everyone else in the lane they're supposed to stay in.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's sort of that's kind of a long-term vision for these things. Would you change anything about the approach of the NRA, I guess, is the other. This is one that a lot of people wonder about. Like, is all this fallout going to change how the NRA looks at the Second Amendment or its advocacy for it, how it approaches politics? Would you change any of that?
Well, I think one thing we certainly need to do is have a spokesperson that can actually get on the television. I mean, the only thing Wayne LaPierre's done in the last 5 years is Newsmax, and the reality is nobody watches that. And so I think that it is wrong for the NRA to hunker down after a tragedy and kind of go silent for a while, because that really leaves the other side open to make accusations that aren't answered. And an accusation that's not answered is admitted. I mean, that's what the whole Fifth Amendment in a criminal case is about. You got to remind the jury that they can't be compelled to testify against themselves, and you can't draw an inference from that. That's not true in the public arena.
Mm-hmm.
They think you're guilty.
Right. Now, do you think the politics the NRA needed, like, how would you view that? Like, do you think there's been lots of critiques from all sides of the NRA over the years, whether it's too willing to compromise? You hear that from a lot of other gun rights groups, or whether it's too extreme in the pro-gun direction. You hear that a lot from, you know, major media outlets or gun control groups, obviously. Do you think that the political path, is that something you would?
I think that right now I'm focused on trying to save it. I come from the perspective of that I'm a 4-H rifle and pistol instructor. I've been teaching children for decades. I'm a hunter safety instructor. I've taught over 5,000 kids hunter education. I'm a master high power rifle instructor from the civilian marksmanship program. And if you saw what I had in my safes in the basement and the other secure room, you'd see what I really enjoy. And while I have played a role in politics. I think that the membership should play a role in divining that answer and not leave it up to the big czar, to figure it out for all of us. I think it's got to be a bottom-up process. And I know that there are vast differences between the membership's opinions regarding individual topics, whether it's bump stocks or do you need one of those black guns or whatever. And, you know, I right now I just want to save the organization and then we can work out all those political questions later. I think this next I think this next election cycle is going to be brutal for our friends.
For who? For Republicans?
Yes. Yeah, it's going to be the worst one in our lifetime. We're going to see all three. We're going to see them all flip. The White House will flip. The Senate will flip. And so will the House. And so, you know, the Senate will be our saving grace. Whether the former president gets reelected or the current president gets reelected, that may be decided by things other than politics, because I think the courts are going to end up affecting that vote significantly.
Interesting. You know, to that end, though, like there's obviously been a lot of criticism of one of the big concerns with this civil case that just ended in New York, that the this verdict that
just half about, over. It's just half over.
It's half over. Yeah. The verdict, the jury reached their fact finding, and but the judge will have to decide on what actually happens from there, as we discussed later on, really at the end of the summer. But one of the big concerns with this whole case in the first place was the Attorney General, Letitia James. She's a Democrat, obviously, in New York, and she had made her political motivations very clear in, you know, when she was running.
Sure.
And so one of the big concerns was that she was going to use her political office to, initially she wanted to dissolve the NRA. That obviously got removed by the judge as a potential remedy for this situation, because it was outside of the interests of the NRA members. I assume you agree with that. Shutting down the NRA was not,
you know, that was one of the reasons that I wanted to get on the board. I was well aware of what she was campaigning on. I knew that she had quite a bit of momentum behind her. I mean, she was the Democratic nominee, and what she said gave me great concern. And when we look at how she has proceeded on this, while I know that they tried to use those comments by her to try to derail her prosecution. You know, people usually do that when the facts aren't with them. Yeah, you know, when they say, they're just picking on me.
And to be fair, the judge did also rule against using that as a reason to dismiss the case altogether. Letitia James,
you know, he took that remedy that she wanted away from her because the judge said he did not want to punish the membership for the sins of the leadership. And I agree with the judge on that. So then she asked to appoint a special master, a monitor over the finances. And honestly, I think NRA needs that.
Do you have concerns about how that might also be used politically, potentially? Like, if you give somebody that much power over the organization with
the judge is the check
which
on
the AG
power.
Wants.
Yeah.
Okay.
The judge is a check on the special master's power. If the special master says, no, you can't do that, then we go have a hearing and argue about it. If he says, yes, I want this done, and he's outside his lane, I think his lane should be limited to making sure that nobody's converting assets to their own advantage, that no board members are getting paid out of the coffers, that it's all being run in a business-like, well-run organization, and we're trying to save the thing, where but he would be able not be able to go into, for example, Isla and start making decisions on who gets endorsed or who doesn't, or who gets a check and who doesn't. He wouldn't be down in the weeds that far. And Isla is a separate entity, too. So I think he would just be looking at NRA and the finances of it. And the judge will define the parameters of his service on that in that position.
OK, so. So you're putting a lot of faith in the judge in this scenario, I guess.
I don't think we have much choice. I don't think these old dogs are going to learn.
Well, I guess that gets to my next point here. You're running for the board again. You have three other people. One of them is Rocky Marshall, who's been on the show before. It was another whistleblower, identified by the jury as a whistleblower in this case. How are you going to go about trying to make progress if you do get elected within the board that currently exists? There's obviously been a lot of criticism of you agreeing to testify for the AG in this case. How are you going to make progress? How do you respond to those critiques, and how are you going to try and convince people to go along with what you want to do?
I hope that they will see the realities that are facing them at this time. One of the biggest problems we have in the way the board operates today is that they hide the real financial information from the majority of the board members. If you go to a finance committee meeting, when they get to the important slides in the PowerPoint, they're going flip, 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 flip so fast you can't write anything down. You can't even get to understand what's in the slide. And if they would start to tell the board members the truth about the finances, which I do not believe they have done to date, then perhaps the board would get the initiative going, because they'd say, oh my God, this is it. I got to do something. And a lot of them, they really like being on the board. And if they want to keep doing it, they've got to make sure that the organization continues. I think that, you're asking me a lot of things that I'm not Gene Dixon. I'm not Gene Dixon. I can't look at a crystal ball. A lot of it's going to depend on what the others choose to do. You know, if Charles Cotton and Marion Hammer don't change their stripes, it's just going to be more the same. So that is not a good recipe for them in court.
What's your response to the idea that you shouldn't have testified for the AG, given some of these critiques that you agreed with earlier on?
I didn't have a choice. They subpoenaed me. I have to respond to the subpoena. I can't be like Carolyn Meadows and destroy evidence. That's not what we do as a judge.
Former president of the NRA.
Yeah. She admitted it in both trials that she knew there was a preservation, and she shredded and burned everything. And she said it with a little smile on her face in this court.
Well, here's the other thing about this sort of limbo that the NRA is in right now between phases of this trial, right? We have a verdict that says the NRA didn't safeguard its charitable assets, that its former face of the organization, the person who built it in large part into what it became, basically stole money from it, essentially. That's what they
did. Well, they did. And I think if you look at the numbers, and in my mind, I think in my 30 years, I think they stole over $500 million. It's only $25 million a year.
Well,
right, that's
obviously that's outside of what was in the trial.
So right. It was.
I can't speak to that, but it's yes, obviously he's been accused of doing a lot more than what was at issue in the specific trial. I would certainly give you that much. But, one of the things that strikes me about this is you have this really bad result from the jury for the organization. But you have this months long limbo where we're not sure if the people who are currently running the organization are going to still be there after July or not. I mean, it sure seems like there's a lot of reason why the judge would appoint these monitors that you've discussed. And that could certainly happen. But in the meantime, isn't it going to be difficult to find people who want to come into the NRA and work on you? I could be stuck working with the people who are there right now. And at this very vital moment where, the NRA has traditionally been a big workhorse for pro-gun candidates especially in federal elections. And we're going into a very major one here. So, how are you viewing all of that? And what do you?
I think that their grasp and their reach in this election cycle is going to be just a fraction of what they once had. They've lost significant credibility with the politicians themselves. They've lost credibility. They've destroyed the brand with the membership. That's why the membership's going down. They're sick and tired of hearing about $250,000 in suits or $7,000 in airplane rides for nieces, $7,000 an hour. For nieces. And, that's probably why they're not renewing. And so I think if they're going to recover, they have to make a clean breast of it and basically start with a new crew, which they have no intention of doing. it's obvious right. to me that the fix was in and they were trying to set up so the Mr. President or someone close to him could be the next EVP. That's why they got rid of the head of general operations, because he would have replaced Wayne, and they got rid of him and they put a sycophant in there that, you know, they can control.
Andrew Rolandum is who you're referring to there.
Yeah. He's not qualified. He's not qualified for the job.
But that's the thing. Like, is anyone going to come into the NRA who would be qualified for that job from outside right now with this potential that the judge could appoint a monitor that could get rid of them as soon as they take office? You see what I'm saying?
Sure. Absolutely. And, you know, that's why they keep looking inside, because that's the only place they can find someone loyal.
Yeah. Well, so is your only hope then for this sort of long-term rebuilding and refresh for the NRA that the current leadership or the majority of it gets removed by the judge in the second?
That certainly could happen in July. The alternative path that we're also, you know, I don't know what the judge is going to do, but the alternative path is to start recruiting more people to run for the board in the next cycle. I expect the four of us will all get elected. We've ran a marginally good campaign. We've certainly done some unique things that no one else has done for trying to reach out to the membership to get their attention and get them to fill that ballot out. The reality is that, only a small percentage, about 65,000 voted in the last election, which was the lowest number ever. And that's what made it possible for us to get on the ballot by petition, because, you know, they weren't going to let us pass the nominating committee again.
Yeah. The nominating committee, is that another thing you would change? The fact that the board gets to pick?
I have heard several options, like not even have anybody on the board on the nominating committee. And, you know, I'm going like, well, how are you going to pick them? And that's the real rub of it, is how do you get them in and how do you keep the process fair? And, you know, nobody's worked out the details on that yet, but they're kicking a lot of ideas around. And it's all kind of woulda, coulda, shoulda, because we can't do nothing right now. Except try to get on the board and do our best to exercise our fiduciary duty and try to keep what is there alive.
But your bottom line is that it's not all dependent on what this judge does in terms of removing personnel from leadership or anything like that. You still think there's a way to reform the organization from inside, even if the judge doesn't remove, you know, the current president and the current EVP.
Yes, it would take board. It would probably take 2 or 3 years. Yes, that we run a slate of candidates that are the reform slate. You know, they're all vetted. They're all, you know, we all make sure they're what they're supposed to be. And then we run 10 or 15 or 20 candidates each year for the next 3 years. And then we'll have a majority of the board, and then we can do what we need to.
And so you view this verdict as, I guess, a game changer in that regard, because obviously this is something that people have been trying to do for several years to this point, to get reform members on the board, and it hasn't worked.
People have been trying to do this for decades. And each of these is an opportunity. The bankruptcy was an exit ramp that might have worked. This trial is an exit ramp that might have worked. And ultimately, you know, running 20 or 30 candidates for the board of directors each year is also another exit ramp that might work. We're just trying to use all of the options and put each of them in the best framework we can, and then hope for the best one way or another.
Mm-hmm. And I guess to round this out here, why do you think that's a better approach than just letting the organization fade away and bringing in new organizations to fill the gap?
There will never be another organization like the National Rifle Association. You have to understand that the 95% of the money that is spent, that effort that is expended by employees and by volunteers, are the things that we never read about in the paper. It's not about whether a bill gets out of committee or whether a horrible crime occurs. It is about supporting the shooting sports and ensuring that the next generation learns to appreciate the Second Amendment through experiencing competitive shooting and hunting, other vocations, other hobbies, other recreational opportunities. Because once these kids learn the methodology, the joy that they have in competition and performing better. And they learn, once they learn the sport, then they learn to appreciate the issue. It doesn't work in the reverse. People don't love the Second Amendment and then decide to go figure out how to shoot a pistol. It's the other way around. And that's why it's so important that NRA's job does it for this generation and the next one. We have lost some of the generations, what you want to call them, Z or millennials or whatever. And, you know, their opinions are not on our side right now. And we've got to start rebuilding that public opinion. The reality is that if you can win public opinion, the politicians will follow. They all want to survive. They all want to get reelected. If you don't win public opinion, you're going to lose friends in the legislature or in the government, because they're going to be beaten by people that match the opinion.
And you think the NRA is the only group capable of doing that?
I don't see anyone stepping into the fray. I mean, you look at Gun Owners of America, you look at Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, the Second Amendment Foundation. Yes, they're doing basically the same job the Firearms Civil Rights Legal Defense Fund does inside NRA, working in the courts, trying to promote Second Amendment issues through the courts. There's nobody out there who's doing anything like this. About the only one is what, the industry group? They'd have some programs for kids and, you know, the guys that put on the SHOT Show and stuff. And they have some programs for kids, but nothing in the scale like NRA or 4-H or the Boy Scouts of America, which NRA supports.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's just nobody, in your view, that's doing all of these things at the national scale that the NRA has done them at.
And you know, they're the
perhaps
only one.
Maybe with the same sort of notoriety and brand that the NRA has as well.
You know, nobody has the list. Nobody has the contacts, the networking that is required to put these things together, like the national matches or, you know, a regiment of competition so that you graduate to a state level competition and then you win that and you go up to the next level. There's nobody else that does that so comprehensively nationwide other than the National Rifle Association.
Hmm. Okay. And so can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, if people want to look up your platform that you're running on and with the other three guys who are running alongside you, how can they do that?
Well, I wish we had the money to update the website, but we haven't got that done. But there's a lot on there that is still accurate. Their website is restorenra.com. That was all pretty much done during the bankruptcy and the period after that was dismissed when, you know, we're trying to elect a replacement for Wayne LaPierre, but I was the only one that nominated and voted for him. So, you know. Sometimes it's an exercise of futility, but you know, you just got to jump on your donkey and tilt at the windmill. Yeah.
And who are the other three candidates?
Candidates with us are Rocky Marshall, who is the best numbers guy I have ever met. And then Jeff Knox, who I knew when he was a little kid and I was on the board with his daddy in the 90s, Neil Knox. And then Dennis Fusaro, who is from the Virginia Citizens Defense League. He's worked for Gun Owners of America, and now he's graduated to being a political consultant, and he's working in statewide campaigns all over the country.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, look, when do people have time? You know, when do they have to turn their ballots in by?
The ballots have to be received before the April 28th. So there's still plenty of time to find that magazine and get it filled out. And one other name, after we got together and we all decided to run, Buzz Mills is one that we've all agreed to support. Buzz was one of the few sitting directors that went with me and Rocky Marshall on the motion to require an examiner to be filed in the motion for an examiner to be filed in the bankruptcy court. Buzz is no-nonsense kind of guy, and he wrote an outstanding letter to the board. He had one more year than I did on the way we were staggered, and so he was still on the board this year, and he's running for re-election. We all support Buzz Mills of Gunsight.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll have to see how the elections turn out and what the makeup of the board is after March, right? That's when we'll find out.
I think some of the board members, that the fact that Wayne has left is actually something that has kind of freed them. Hmm. And, you know, there are those that would abstain in the secret elections, you know, but they would still abstain and they wouldn't vote for Wayne LaPierre to be EVP again. So there may be some friends that we have there that we just don't know yet because they were too scared and intimidated to step out.
Okay.
And we'll see. Of course, you know, they still, you know, Marion Hammer still sent an email saying, if you step out of line, we're going to remove you from your committee assignments.
We will see. We will see what happens in this upcoming NRA election. And then obviously what happens with the second phase of the civil suit in New York. And perhaps we'll have you back on the show at that point once we have a few more developments.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity and I appreciate your tolerance, me being late, but you know, court is court. What can I do? You know,
no worries at all. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to head over to our news update now.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the news update. I'm contributing writer Jake Fogelman, joined as always by Reload founder Stephen Gutowski. How are we doing this week, Steve?
I'm doing pretty good. Been a busy week. Obviously, we're going to get into some more of that on the show here now. But yeah, doing all right. Got a Flyers game tonight, so I'm looking forward to that. But we'll talk a little bit more about what we're up to at the end of the news segment. So what do we got in terms of headlines this week?
Sure. Yeah. So some of the newsletter links, one of them comes from the Charleston City Paper. It's sort of an update on the ongoing, saga with permitless carry in South Carolina, one of the states considering it this year. And there's been a little bit of a hang up between the House and the Senate. So each has passed a version of permitless carry. And there seems to be some irreconcilable differences between the versions that they're trying to hash out. And it's potentially imperiling the hopes of gun rights advocates to get a permitless carry there right now. So it remains to be seen. It's still a potential, but it's not looking great at the moment.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they're going to get that one through this year, but you never know. And then I think you've written about this before, right? I mean, and we'll get into Louisiana a little bit later, but you're starting to get to the ceiling, I think, for this policy. Obviously, pretty high ceiling, 28, 29, 30 states. Maybe end up with permitless carry, but you're starting to run out of those triple red states, at least for now. You know, obviously, the election's coming up. Maybe that'll shift things in some states. But as things stand right now, it sure seems like the permitless carry, people call it constitutional carry. Obviously, advocates call it that. And there's not a lot of landing room left here for that, right?
No, that's absolutely right. And I mean, even the South Carolina case shows you, even in triple red state, that's no slam dunk, right? You're getting to that point where some of those are even tougher to sell. So like you said, we're rapidly approaching, I think, the ceiling for where permitless carry is going to go for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, certainly. Sort of like red flag laws. They kind of ran out of space where you'd have a state that might actually consider them. Although you have seen some forays in place like Tennessee, but inevitably, ultimately, they haven't come through yet past the sort of blue and purple blue states out there. And I think it's a similar dynamic here for permitless carry, except there's a lot more of the triple red states.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And the next story comes to us from the New Jersey Monitor, and it's an interesting finding. The state's attorney general just came out with a report this week stating that micro stamping is viable. So another one of these attorney general led claims that we've seen this before. It happened in California. But he said that they did some live testing and they worked with a company that made a prototype with micro stamping, and their results found that micro stamping is now viable. So they're going to create a whole new roster of micro stamping enabled guns. And once that's published under New Jersey law, all gun stores have to make at least one model from that roster available in their inventory.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out in practice, because obviously, I mean, one of the fascinating things here is that New Jersey's law seems to be a bit more limited than California's law was before California actually stopped defending that part of its handgun roster because of, court cases. It seems like they determined that was the least defensible part of their handgun roster. it was like last year, I guess, is when that happened.
Yeah.
Because in effect in California, what this micro stamping requirement did, and they had it on any gun after the technology was found to be viable, had to have that included, any handgun, or it couldn't be sold. And well, this is going to be a problem in New Jersey too, but the reality is nobody makes this guns with this technology at all and never has. So, whatever the Attorney General's office might find to be viable in their opinion, has not translated at all to actual real world availability, and not just in the United States too. Like it'd be one thing if it was, just the American gun industry or the gun rights movement in the US being resistant to this, which they are obviously, certainly. But you also don't see this overseas anywhere either. The Chinese or the European gun makers nobody has implemented micro stamping, even though New Jersey and California claim it's a viable technology. Which I think is similar to smart guns, where like if it was just about recalcitrance here in the United States to these sorts of technologies and concerns over what they could be used for in terms of, you know, tracking gun owners or whatever, there's all kinds of different critiques of this. If that was the only reason they didn't come to market, presumably you would still see them in guns in other parts of the world where they don't have those same kinds of concerns, and you don't. So that's, I think, a better objective look at this stuff than what either political side in the U.S. says about them. In California, it resulted in basically a total ban on new handguns being sold in the state. New Jersey, if they never put a gun into that roster, then maybe the gun stores won't be required to carry it. We'll have to look into a little bit more of how this law is going to work in practice. Because
right,
New Jersey, of course, was one of the reasons that smart guns were so so controversial here in the United States for such a long time, because they previously had a law that they modified to be closer to what this is, where initially they claimed as soon as a smart gun, biometric locking gun, I guess, came to market anywhere in the United States, that would be the only kind of gun that could be sold in New Jersey. And so that created a very significant incentive for the gun industry and gun rights advocates in the United States to oppose the development of those firearms as well. So, I guess they're trying not to make exactly the same mistake here. but I don't know. We'll see what happens with this. If none of these guns ever come to market, are they still going to try and force New Jersey gun stores to sell a thing that doesn't actually exist?
Right.
I don't know.
No, like you said, we'll have to stay on top of it. My read of it is similar to yours, where I think they're trying to avoid the micro stamping or the smart gun fiasco, and by doing a little bit of a lighter touch, quote unquote. But like you said,
for
New Jersey standards. Right. You're right. But we'll stay on top of it to see where it goes. It's still
the
very first finding California, that they released.
California didn't care about the repercussions that it became effectively a total ban on new handguns, that they were okay with that. I don't know how New Jersey's going to react.
Right. We'll see. And then the last link we're going to talk about today comes to us from Courthouse News Service about an interesting, speaking of California, interesting ruling out of California, where a trio of prospective would-be gun owners sued the state with help from Firearms Policy Coalition, a gun rights group, because these folks had been convicted of nonviolent felonies in other states and later had their records sealed or expunged and had their rights restored in those other states. But under California's firearms purchasing laws, California doesn't care if you've had your rights restored elsewhere, even if that's where the crime was. And so these people were prevented from purchasing firearms and owning firearms in the state of California. And this judge said that, no, California, you can't do that. You have to provide this avenue for these folks to have their rights restored. So interesting ruling.
Yeah. Another loss for California in the federal court system. Really not a very uncommon thing these days. The question has been whether or not as it moves up the chain to the Ninth Circuit panel and then whether they go to an en banc panel is sort of something we talked about last week on the show, right? That's the bigger question, is these lower court rulings against California's gun restrictions are not terribly uncommon. It's just a matter of whether they survive appeals, which the government has had a very easy go of it at the higher levels of the Ninth Circuit since Heller, really. But it might be changing. So we'll have to follow this case as well and see where it all ends up.
Right. And sort of the latest, it's not only for California, but just nationwide in this trend of nonviolent felonies and gun rights and sort of ongoing criminal justice implications intersecting with the Second Amendment. So certainly something we'll want to stay on top of going forward.
Yeah. And something the Supreme Court is probably going to delve into. You know, they had their oral arguments in Rahimi a couple months back, which was about domestic violence restraining orders and sort of the violent side of gun prohibitions. They also have another case called Range that they're considering, and Daniels as well, that are more on the nonviolent side of gun prohibitions. And so the high court may weigh in on all this not too far into the future as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then heading into some of the stories we wrote this week, speaking of permitless carry again, Louisiana just became, or is soon to become, the 28th state to adopt permitless carry. Their legislature just passed the bill. Their governor, Jeff Landry, who's a Republican, he replaced their former two-term Democratic governor, has already said, I'm going to sign this into law. He called for it at the onset of this special session that they just had. So very soon, Louisiana will be the 28th state to allow permitless carry.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to that political dynamic we talked about earlier, it's, I think, one of the reasons you don't see this move beyond the red states. I mean, first of all, I think it shows perhaps how effective the gun rights movement is, regardless of everything going on with the NRA or whatever else, how effective they still are in red states. Inside of the Republican Party, the gun rights movement is very effective. And this permitless carry campaign across the country, I think, is certainly evidence of that. I mean, the concealed carry sort of revolution, you might call it, overall, is definitely evidence of the potency of the gun rights movement at the state level, because it was not that long ago where most states did not allow concealed carry at all. It was banned in most states, and wasn't until, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, when you started to see permitting for concealed carry come along. And then, you know, by 2010, I believe that was... In 2010, there were only two states. I think it was Alaska and Vermont. And Alaska was also, you know, 20th century development, I think late 20th century, early 21st century. I think it was 2003, maybe.
2003, yeah.
Okay, yeah, good. So you know for sure, because I thought it was 2003. Before 2003, it was just Vermont.
Right.
In fact, people used to call this policy Vermont carry, which is where you don't need a permit at all to conceal carry. As long as you can legally possess a firearm, you can legally carry it. And then, you know, by 2010, that's when Arizona changed as well. And so you had three at that point and one, you know, sort of growing state. You know, Alaska is obviously a pretty unique scenario with firearms and carrying them around in such a huge remote state like that. But Arizona started to become more of a mainstream thing to go permitless. But that was only back in 2010. And now here we are 14 years later, and you've got 28 states, maybe 29 soon. And, you know, there's possibility you could see a couple other states on top of that. So it really is evidence of how potent that movement has been for concealed carry. And it's resulted in a lot more people concealed carrying now as well. And perhaps changed American gun culture to part of that whole new gun culture 2.0, more focused on self-defense than on hunting or recreational shooting. And this is a big part of that. But, you know, it's also emblematic of the power of the gun rights movement, because these policies don't poll very well. I think this also gets to sort of why we're talking about a ceiling here, that this is hitting a ceiling. Now look, ceilings are not necessarily permanent, right? We just described there the whole history of this. It used to be totally illegal. Then it was a permitted thing. If you went through the proper licensing scheme, and now it's moved to in those states, no permit at all. And it could soon, you could soon see that elsewhere in these other holdout states. I mean, some of them will probably have to be forced by the courts if it ever gets to that point. That's obviously what Bruin was about in 2022. But, you know, there's certainly things could change down the line, but currently it doesn't poll very well. It's not a very popular concept to eliminate permitting for concealed carry. And so that, I think, leads to a lot of hesitancy in states that aren't as committed to, you know, where the gun rights movement doesn't have as much influence or control over politicians because of how polarized the issue is in a lot of the states where Democrats have control, they aren't as open to this concept. But, you know, that could certainly change as things move on. If there isn't some sort of extremely noticeable rise in crimes committed by people who wouldn't have been able to, who are affected by this policy, right? So not people with convictions already anyway, but you know, if there isn't a marked change, if people don't notice this policy being so much worse than the previous ones, approval for it could certainly rise over time, I would think. And that opens up more doors down the line.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. But once again, we'll stay on top of that. And then on to the big news of the week. The Supreme Court just heard oral arguments in not a Second Amendment case, but a gun-related case, the Cargill versus Garland, dealing with bump stocks, the Trump-era bump stock ban. Just had its oral argument before the court. Both you and I listened to the oral arguments, and you covered it for the site. If you want to just tell us some of your big takeaways from how that oral argument went.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, right? Because we talked a lot about this bump stock case in the lead up as being very connected to most of the other ATF rule cases, right? These other ATF bans on like pistol braces and so-called ghost guns, right? Unfinished firearms parts or parts kits. And even the private sale of used guns, how they're trying to clamp down on that as well. And you know, after these oral arguments, I am wondering a bit more about how closely connected they're going to be, because most of this case, and perhaps this makes sense if you think about it, but most of this case was very laser focused on just the actual function, the technical function of a bump stock, how it works in practice, you know, when equipped on a semi-automatic rifle, and the what exactly the definition of machine gun means in the National Firearms Act, because that's what the ATF did, right? They reclassified these devices as machine gun parts, essentially. So it said that actually the bump stock, after years of saying under multiple administrations that these were just firearms accessories, they were not machine gun parts, and they weren't regulated at all by the National Firearms Act or the Gun Control Act. They obviously, you had the Las Vegas shooting in 2017, where so the only crime that we know of being committed by somebody using a bump stock equipped gun also happens to be the worst mass shooting in American history. So that threw a lot of things into chaos from, you know, a political standpoint. And President Trump at the time ordered the ATF to ban these devices. And the way that the ATF accomplished that was through rulemaking, where they said these things were actually always illegal. And so, you know, it's illegal for you to possess them. Will give you a grace period to turn them in or destroy them. And after that, you will be a felon if you are caught with one. Now, most people did not either turn them in, or at least they didn't turn them in. Nobody, who knows what people did with them exactly. But, and there haven't been, I don't think there have been any federal prosecutions over this that I'm aware of. There have been some state level prosecutions under laws that were created that sort of mirrored this ban, but I don't think there have been any federal prosecutions. But regardless, that's how the ATF got to the ban, was saying, well, actually, these things are machine guns. And so the court case, the oral arguments, were almost entirely about like what you know, the definition deals with if a gun can fire automatically more than one round after a single function of the trigger, then it's a machine gun, according to the NFA. And so most of this was focused on function of the trigger and what exactly that means. And that it was pretty laser focused on that. And it got pretty, I think at certain points, the justices, the things got well beyond their grasp of how firearms work. And so you got into a lot of hypotheticals and black box guns and, well, what if it has, what if you have to press several buttons to make it fire automatically or something? And it got pretty convoluted at points. But they were almost entirely focused on this question of what is the function of a trigger? What does that mean? A function of the trigger, a single function. And so, you know, it didn't really focus much on the sort of flip-flopping, which we talked about in a lot of these other cases. The ATF has kind of changed its mind through over the years about what a pistol brace is or what's a finished firearm part and what's not regulated unfinished firearm part, or what is a bump stock. So there was a little bit of talk about that, especially from the conservative justices, but it was almost entirely this examination of the definition of function, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. That was my takeaway from watching it. What about you, or listening to it?
Yeah, it for sure got into the weeds pretty quickly. As you said, I think we got to a point very quickly where we exhausted the justices' knowledge of firearms and sort of the mechanics of firearms. And it became very apparent by some of the questions and the hypotheticals. But another big contextual clue.
And they would say that they were confused a number of times. Yeah. They were just like, I'm confused about what's happening.
Which, you know, it, in its own right, maybe is a tell about where this comes down, right? Because some of the arguments that have been made, at least at the lower court levels, is like, well, when there's ambiguity in statutes, does the tie go to the runner? Basically, does the tie go to the average person over the ATF? So we'll see if that makes a difference. But it is telling that uncertainty came. But
the rule of lenity, it's interesting they didn't actually specifically talk about the rule of lenity, because that's where that would come in the
right.
And maybe that's because it would apply in a criminal case,
right.
if somebody was actually arrested over this and went to court, the rule of lenity would probably come into play. And the lower courts did explicitly talk about that point, but it right. wasn't much of that discussion in the actual oral arguments, at least not explicitly where they literally said the words rule of lenity.
It could be maybe, I don't know if rule of lenity just was excluded from the question presented when the Supreme Court granted cert. And so they're only very narrowly deciding if the technical definition meets the NFA.
That is how the question came out. That's the only question that was at play. And one honestly, other, the way the question was written, it sort of almost assumes that bump stocks are machine guns in the language right. that it used. So that, I don't know. It's interesting. But yeah, so the question doesn't talk about rule of lenity, but they did talk about the flip-flopping and the sort of legal peril that puts a lot of Americans in. And the government even sort of conceded on several points about that, that if they did bring charges, these would be a big problem for them. But it was interesting not to hear them talk explicitly about the concept of the rule of lenity and almost entirely focus on what the heck function of a trigger means.
But I also think one thing that was very clear was the practical concern that a lot of the justices had, even on both sides, both the conservative and liberal justices, were very clearly uncomfortable with what bump stocks do, whether or not they agree with the ATF's interpretation. But you heard even Justice Barrett say, like, it's clear that we don't want these rapid fire things on the streets, but I'm just struggling to see how the definition fits. Or you hear about even Justice Gorsuch talking about, okay, we want machine guns to be banned, but are these machine guns? So I thought that was interesting. And I think people need to realize that I don't think any of the justices are comfortable with automatic weapons and machine guns and that sort of a thing. Oh, yeah. It's just a matter of finding, can the ATF actually classify these accessories as the same category under law as a machine gun?
Yeah, and I wrote a member's piece about this, going into like where each justice seemed to come down based on the questions they asked. Now, you know, look, we're interpreting the oral arguments here, right? And that's always a bit tricky because you don't know exactly why a justice is asking a question the way they are. They don't always come out in the written opinion. the same way they might have sounded in oral arguments. You know, you can kind of try to read the tea leaves, but, and I think in this case, it was particularly difficult to figure out where the majority is going to be, because you had, now, one thing I'll say is like it was clear that they were focused on this particular question about what function of the trigger means and how exactly bump stocks work practically. And then I think it was also pretty clear where the liberals on the court stood, which is that they either thought that bump stocks do fit into the text itself, or, like you noted, they think that it's within the spirit of the law, I guess you would say. Like, it's, there was a lot of focus on rate of fire, that bump stocks can help you reach a rate of fire that is similar to a machine gun. Of course, you can also do that without a bump stock by just bump firing, which the government did admit, and there were several questions about that. But they were much more concerned about rate of fire, necessarily, it seemed like. And certainly all the liberal justices, I think, was plainly, they're plainly going to be on the side of the ATF. From the, that's, I think, is fairly safe to say, reading the oral arguments and listening to them. But the conservative justice, on the other hand, is a little less clear. You know, to me, I thought Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, even though, like you mentioned, they both explicitly said that they think these things should be banned, or at least they agree with the concept of banning them. Which is interesting, yeah, for the point that you're making, that these are, it's very unlikely that, I know a lot of people, sort of an ancillary point, but I know a lot of people, especially gun rights activists, will read Bruin and think, wow, this, you can even hear gun control activists talk about it this way as well. This really imperils a lot of gun laws. And of course, the NFA, and in particularly the Hughes Amendment, which banned new sales of machine guns back in 1986, is a particular thorn in the side for a lot of online gun rights activists, I would say. You know, people who are very, you know, watch a lot of gun tubers and probably listen to the show or something like that too. You know, that there's a lot of opposition in the activist community against the National Firearms Act and machine guns that I just don't think is shared by the Supreme Court at all. You know, obviously they made a specific carve out in dicta, not, you know, it's not binding, but in dicta that banning things like M16s, fully automatic weapons, is fine, or at least it's not being questioned by Heller. And this case is another example of, like, I don't think the court is going that far down the path of just eliminating all gun laws, because it's hard to, just because it's hard to imagine a historical justification for them, even though that might be how you should read Bruin. Obviously, people have very different opinions on how you should read Bruin, but certainly you can get to that conclusion of, you know, there's no history or tradition. There weren't bans on these sorts of guns at the founding. I mean, of course, we're talking about guns that didn't exist at the founding. There were some analogs to some degree at the founding, But you know, the Maxim machine gun didn't come along until that sort of automatic fire didn't come along until the late 19th, early 20th centuries. So, if at the very least, if any indication, as an aside here, that the justices are not, even the more conservative ones, are not likely to be on board with fully automatic weapons. But regardless, you know, Gorsuch and Barrett both explicitly said that they agree with the idea of banning bump stocks, really, presumably in addition to machine guns. But they also seemed the most likely to, the most skeptical of the government, honestly, because they said, yeah, maybe these should be banned, but I don't think the statute actually does that. And that was a problem for them. And, you know, I thought the other ones are a little harder to read, but I could still see at least a 5-4 ruling against the ATF being the most likely outcome. Maybe not a, certainly not a guaranteed outcome, I wouldn't think, but, you know, you had Kavanaugh and Gorsuch were very concerned about the legal jeopardy that this puts people in and the flip-flopping that we mentioned earlier. Kavanaugh was also seemed to be Kavanaugh and Alito also seemed to be pretty clear on the idea that a function of the trigger is just, you know, a single actuation of the trigger. And you don't get multiple shots with a bump stock when you pull the trigger once. You have to pull, you have to actuate it. Pull it is not perhaps the right word for how bump firing works, but actuate, you have to press the trigger rearward and so that it drops the sear for every single round that's fired. You just bump firing allows you to do that way faster than you could with, you know, traditional pulling of the trigger with your, just your finger. So, I don't know. Roberts is probably the least, probably the hardest to pick up on, because Thomas, you know, Thomas, I think he was one of the ones who asked explicitly about, you know, what is this? What about the whole idea that you can bump fire without a bump stock? Why is that not, you know, equally concerning, or why is that okay? But bump stock, having a bump stock piece of plastic on there to assist you is not okay. Barrett got into some of the same critiques she was talking about, like using rubber bands basically to help you accomplish bump firing. And the government did try to argue that those wouldn't be considered machine guns, you know, because basically the bump stock helps you do all that automatically as a single motion, essentially. And they all had questions that were also skeptical of the plaintiffs too, of Cargill, especially with the concept that, you know, the liberals were getting at too, and that you mentioned earlier with this sort of that the idea of bump stocks is kind of to try and circumvent the law here. And so, you know, maybe they'll find that is not allowed, even if the bump stock doesn't technically violate the text of the statute. Roberts was, again, probably the hardest to read, though, because he didn't really ask any questions that would give you insight into what he's thinking. He literally just asked both sides how the bump stock functionally works, whether you have to keep forward pressure or if you move your support hand back and forth to fire the gun. That was sort of he was trying to get an understanding of that. And he didn't even really like express which explanation he agreed with either either side. So I have no idea what Roberts is going to do.
I agree. He was tough to read, but also just to the broader point of how technical and specific these questions were, really honing in on that phrase, single function of the trigger, kind of maybe has implications for, you know, we've talked about similar rules that the ATF has been promulgating, and perhaps this bump stock case would shine some insight into how those might be perceived by the justices. And because of how hyper specific they were on that specific portion of the NFA, I'm not sure that it really is going to intersect too much. You know, this kind of ties into another story we talked about where the ATF's frames and receivers rule just got called into question, interestingly, from the gun control side, who said that it didn't go far enough in California. Yeah. And we thought maybe, okay, the bump stock case, whatever ruling they hand out in that, maybe will shine some light into how the frames and receivers rule is. And I'm not sure it necessarily will, which is interesting.
Yeah, that was my takeaway too. You know, like I said at the top, we've been looking at these cases, and this case in particular, like it was going to be really answer the questions for all these following rules. Because, you know, you figure the court's been pretty skeptical of administrative power, and they're going to go through and say, well, you don't, you know, and you might still get that ruling, right? This is where the sort of Gorsuch, Barrett questions come in, because they're like, well, we might agree with you that this should be banned, but we don't see that this is actually, that it actually fits under the text of the law. And that is kind of what all these cases are going to be about, to, if you think about it, to a certain extent. Yeah. But maybe they'll be a little more technical than we expected, where they're going to take a lot more time focusing on the various arguments about what, whether this ATF interpretation of the statute was right or not. So, you know, in that sense, what comes out in this case might not have a major bearing on what happens in the pistol brace case or the ghost gun case or the private used gun sales case. So, yeah, maybe it'll be a little bit less impactful than we thought on that front. I think this collection, they all are pretty related cases. I guess it just comes down to maybe the court sides with them on one and sides of the ATF's interpretation in this one and not in the pistol brace one. I don't know. It'll be interesting. I mean, it should give us some insight, you think, right? Like,
right.
Maybe it'll give us insight into how much leeway they're going to allow the ATF to have with this kind of stuff. They seem to have been pretty strict about it with other agencies like the EPA, right? But, maybe here they'll be a little bit more lenient with the language or the intention of the law will come into play a lot more. I don't know. I guess that's the thing. Like, you can only read so much out of this. And the biggest takeaway to me was, that we don't know exactly what kind of direction the court is going to go in here. Like the Rahimi oral arguments, I think were easier to read because it was pretty clear that nobody was going to side with Rahimi.
Yeah.
The question is what they're going to hand down when they rule against him, I guess, is the feeling you get from that. This one, maybe it'll be a 6-3 because maybe all the conservatives will end up going the same way, or will it be a 5-4? And if it's a 5-4, which direction is it a 5-4? I think that's those are all still possibilities that I see from this. And then, the ghost gun, unfinished frames and receivers case out of California is fascinating because, like, all of these cases have obviously been gun rights advocates suing the ATF over claims that they've exceeded their authority in how they're reclassifying all this stuff to, make it more restrictive to obtain them or to make them or to sell them, the different devices. And this one goes the opposite way. It's gun rights group suing the ATF because they weren't strict enough and a court agreed with them, a federal judge out in California. It'll be really interesting to see how that all interacts when the other cases where federal courts have agreed with the gun rights plaintiffs along the same basic argument that we've seen in the bump stock case, how those cases all come together and interact with one another is going to be pretty fascinating.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it only just adds fuel to, I wrote a members piece a few weeks back about the court one way or another is going to have to weigh in on the ghost gun rule in particular, just sort of procedurally, the stay that they put on the lower court rulings vacating it made that almost inevitable. And now when you have a countervailing side saying, well, the rules are also invalid for another reason, I think it provides even more motivation that, okay, someone has to weigh in here one way or the other. If both sides are kind of eating away at the rule, you're going to need some guidance at some point. So we'll have to keep on top of that.
We will absolutely follow that. But how are you doing this week? You asked me at the top and I didn't ask you back. So how are you doing? I think you've been pretty busy, right? With the Colorado legislature's in full force now.
Yeah, I'm good, but it's been a very busy week, not only just because, everything we talked about during the show, it's been a big, big week for guns, but also my other job. I obviously work in policy in Colorado and we're in the legislative session and kind of in the dead middle of it. And there's a lot going on. So extremely busy, but, it's what I like to do. So I can't complain too much.
Yeah. You do the energy policy stuff for Independence Institute, right? So a lot of work, presumably a lot going on with that in Colorado at the moment. So you are a busy guy. Are you going to be doing anything fun over the weekend or
just work? Say right in line with that. I'm going to be trying to catch up on some stuff over the weekend. I'll try to do something fun. Maybe the weather's been actually really nice in Colorado. So I'd like to get out maybe a little, maybe I'll try to stick my head up, come up for air a bit, but I also do have to catch up on a lot of work. So what about you? I think you've got some, as the shirt indicates, I think you're going to watch some hockey this weekend.
Yes, I'm going to the Flyers game tonight. We're filming on Friday and they're playing in DC tonight. This is the last game in DC for the Flyers this season. They're trying to move that whole stadium over to my side of the river here in Virginia, which I think would be a huge debacle. Actually, it might implicate gun policy in Virginia because the Democrats, obviously the Republican Glenn Youngkin is the governor. He wants the stadium thing to happen in in Arlington, Virginia, Potomac Yard. But yeah, unless you live here, you're not going to know what that is. But basically, Northern Virginia, right across from D.C. Right now, the stadium is in Chinatown area of D.C. And D.C. is having a lot of crime problems, unlike the rest of the country, where you've seen a huge decrease in murder over the last year in 2023. There was like a record decrease, right? We've talked about it a little bit on the show a while back. We should actually probably do another show on the final numbers. DC was one of those outliers where murder went up. Crime has been a terrible problem in the city. And so this, I think, may be part of the reason why the Capitals and Wizards want to, their owners want to, they want a new stadium generally. The stadium's fine, honestly. It's Verizon Center, or whatever they call it now. I think it's changed names. It's perfectly fine, but I think it's 20 or 30 years old. So all the owners always want new stadiums and new development projects and whatever. And they're always looking for somebody to pay them lots of money to do that. And Virginia's willing to do that, I guess, in this case, or at least the governor is. And the Democratic House and Senate are not as willing to go down this road. And they want, to make a deal, to have trade-offs. And one of the things they want is some of the gun policies that they're pushing through. That Virginia, the legislature passed the assault weapons ban just recently, and they have explicitly along party lines. Every Democrat has voted for that policy, which is remarkable in and of itself to see the party go that direction. And I think they have like 27 total bills that are, new gun restrictions. And they almost every single one of them has passed along party lines. I think there's been one Republican senator who's gotten on board with three or four of them, the less restrictive measures. But it's been a pretty remarkable political situation here. We haven't talked about it a lot because it's very unlikely to result in actual policy and actual laws, because the governor, I did reach out to his office when this happened, and they said that he didn't have any new updates on the specific bills, but that he stood by his comments from earlier in the year at the State of the State address, where he said that Virginia already has among the strictest gun laws in the country, which, the Virginia has universal background checks. It has local gun-free zones. It has a lot of those sort of restrictions in place now. It doesn't have an assault weapons ban, as we just mentioned, but that was because the Democrats actually in the Senate in 2020 killed that bill at the time after, there's huge protests in Richmond during that period. But anyway, this all might get wrapped up into this whole stadium drama, because it's not certain that stadium complex thing is actually going to happen. And there may be some sort of political horse trading that goes on that could implicate gun policy in Virginia. I don't think it's going to. It doesn't appear like that's going to happen, but it is a possibility. And so perhaps we'll have to cover that more closely in the future here. But anyway, all that to say, I'm going to the Flyers game and it should be fun.
You can think about all that while you're sitting in your seat at the stadium tonight.
Yes, that's what'll be on my mind primarily. I think it's very unlikely that you see most of these gun bills actually get into law here in Virginia. Maybe some of the smaller ones down the line that had that Republican senator on board. But even then, I don't know that Youngkin is on board. He's not been very vocal one way or the other, but from what his office told me, he doesn't appear to be interested in signing a bunch of these into law or letting them go into law by not signing, by holding them or whatever. He's probably going to veto the vast majority, if not all of them. So we'll keep on top of that just in case something does materialize beyond what they've already told me. I think that's all we've got, right, for this week. We'll be back again next week. I'm actually headed up to Columbia University next week to speak to a class there. I did it last year. It's a lot of fun. Been going to New York a lot lately. I was up there a bunch for the New York trial of the NRA, and now I'm headed back up for a day for this Columbia University thing. Looking forward to it. The students, not really kids anymore. These were graduate students, but they were great last time. Very thoughtful and interesting discussion. So I look forward to that, and I'll probably give you guys a little roundup of it maybe next week. But yeah, that's all I've got for this week. You got anything else?
Yeah, that should do it for this week.
All right. Well, if you guys like what we do here at The Reload and you want to support our reporting, you can head over and buy a membership at thereload.com. That is how we fund our operations, and that is how we're able to bring you independent, informed reporting on firearms policy and politics from a sober and serious perspective. So, you know, if you want to be part of that, you can head over. Of course, you also get access to hundreds of pieces of analysis and exclusive stories that you won't find anywhere else. So there is a lot of value in the membership as well. You'll get this podcast a day early and the opportunity to appear on the show in a member segment as well. To do another one of those soon. It's been a little while. And a Q&A too. We got to do a Q&A. Maybe we'll do one next week for the, you know, the whole NRA situation and all that. Maybe we'll see. We got to do one soon for sure. That's another member's perk. But if you're not ready to purchase a membership today, you can of course help us by spreading word about The Reload and sharing this podcast or any of our stories with people you think would be interested in them, and leaving us a good rating or a comment wherever you're listening to this at. And yeah, that's all we've got for this week. We will see you guys again real soon.
No, the devil's got no